World Challenge President Gary Wilkerson often speaks on receiving a baptism of love from the Holy Spirit. That touch allowed him to care for those he barely knew and share with them the gospel of Jesus Christ, even though he describes himself as an introvert who is not always comfortable talking to strangers. In part 5 of Triumph Through Tragedy, we'll hear letters from people who were obedient to God's leading and showed compassion to those who needed it most, and how that simple act of faith touched their lives too. Triumph Through Tragedy is brought to you by World Challenge, transforming lives through the message and mission of Jesus Christ. These podcasts are made possible only through generous donors like you. You can donate on our website, worldchallenge.org. Now, here's Stephanie Staples Rostad and Jason Staples with Part 5, Ministering to and Caring for Others.
3 hours a night for 3 nights equals a miracle. 25 years ago, I worked in the emergency room at a large medical center in Los Angeles. I was young, my mother had just died, and I was trying to just get through my shift at work. I worked the swing shift, which is from 3 p.m. to 11:30 p.m. One evening, a woman came to my workstation and told me her brother, an inpatient, was in a coma and was expected to die that night. She lived in another state and had to head home right away to take care of another urgent family matter. What she really wanted was to sign body release forms for her brother so that when he died, his body could be released to the family without anyone having to come back to California. I referred this lady to the appropriate place to get the help she needed, but before she left, I asked her about her brother. She told me that his name was Bob Scott. He was in his early 40s and dying of cancer. He was married but had been separated from his wife for many years, and he had not seen his 2 teenage daughters since they were very small. I could identify with this family situation. Not only had my mother just suddenly died from a heart attack at the age of 53, my father had died from a cerebral hemorrhage at the age of 36 when I was only 6. To make my empathy complete, my 17-year-old sister had died from cancer when I was 16. This made me very sensitive to this man's condition. Bob's sister told me that he had no family in the area, so I asked her if she would like my friend Jenny and me to spend time with him so he wouldn't be alone. She was happy that we would do this and gave us her permission. With that, she left. This was a Friday night. Jenny and I had been having our own Bible study on our breaks, so we always took our Bibles to work. This Friday night on our late break, around 10 o'clock, we went up to meet Bob. He was in a coma, so naturally we did not speak to him, but we prayed for him and left. In Matthew 18:19, Jesus says, "Again I say to you, that if 2 of you agree on earth concerning anything that they ask, it will be done for them by my Father in heaven." We decided that we would take God at His word, literally. So for the first time in my life, I asked God for the miraculous. We asked Him to bring Bob out of his coma so we could speak to him. After praying, we went to find Bob's doctors. I had worked at this hospital for several years, and I knew almost all the doctors. When we found Bob's doctor, he told us that he had been in a coma for a day or so, and indeed was expected to die that night. Jenny and I went back to work, and when our shift was over, we went back up to Bob's room. This time, when we walked in, Bob was out of his coma. We were so excited. We introduced ourselves to him and told him how we had met his sister. He had that death look about him, which I easily recognized because of my hospital experience and the loss of my family members. Jenny and I stayed with Bob for 3 hours, mostly just sitting with him and stroking his forehead, arms, and hands. He was clearly in pain, and touch was comforting. When we left his room to go home, we asked God for more. We asked Jesus to reveal Bob's heart condition to us, because we wanted to know whether he was saved or not. The next day, Saturday, Jenny and I could hardly wait to get back to work. We didn't know if Bob would be alive or not, and if alive, whether he would be alert, and further, if alert, would he reveal what was in his heart? We ended up going to work 2 hours early so we could spend some time with him if he was still alive. When we walked into Bob's room, there he was, alive and alert. Jenny and I began to share with him that Jesus loved him and cared about his life-threatening situation. Bob immediately revealed his heart's condition by saying that he did not believe what we said about Jesus. We continued to reassure him and asked him if he cared if we prayed for him and read to him out of the Bible. He gave his consent. When we left to go to work, we asked the Lord, "Please, Lord, keep him alive long enough for us to be sure he hears the gospel and has a chance to accept Jesus as his Savior. We went up to see him on each of our breaks just to sit with him. After work, we went into Bob's room and stayed for the next 3 hours. We shared the gospel with him as clearly as we could. We constantly reassured him of God's love for him and his concern for his physical condition. Bob was nice about it, but he kept telling us that he did not believe it. After leaving to go home that night, we asked the Lord to let us know if Bob got saved. We acknowledged that we did not need to know, but we would like to know. On Sunday, we went again to work 2 hours early to sit with Bob and reassure him that God loved him. We spent both our breaks and lunchtime with him, and after work, we went up to spend our usual 3 hours with him. When we walked into his room this time, he reached out and took hold of our hands, one hand of each of us as we stood on opposite sides of his bed. After he kissed the back of our hands, he said, "Any time two young girls will spend this kind of time with a man they don't know, it must be true. God must love me, and I must accept Jesus as my Savior." After Bob spoke those words, several things happened. For one, the pain left him, and an expression of indescribable peace came over his face. What appeared to be a halo of light surrounded his head. In retrospect, I believe this was the Shekinah glory of God as Bob prepared to enter his presence. Bob slipped back into his coma, never to come out of it again. Needless to say, Jenny and I were ecstatic. We sobbed tears of joy at being privileged to witness the rebirth of a soul. We stayed there our usual 3 hours, but anticipating Bob's passing, we asked the Lord this one more thing. We told the Lord that we would stay an additional 20 minutes, why we chose that length of time I do not know, and that if he was going to take Bob home, would he please allow us to be there? God gave us what we had asked. 20 minutes later, Bob died. The next day, I went back up to the ward and shared with one of the ward nurses, a Christian. When I told her that Bob got saved, she was amazed. I learned two things from this nurse. She told me that Bob had refused to let the Protestant chaplain, the Catholic priest, or any other religious staff come near his room. Obviously, God knew that it would take a common person that Bob would not reject to reach him. I am so glad he chose Jenny and me. I also learned that in those 3 days, no one had seen Bob out of his coma except the two of us. A couple of days later, I was reflecting on the loss of my mother and how God had saved Bob. I had my devotions. The little booklet I chose to read was all about how God can take a time of personal tragedy and turn it into enormous victory. I was so blessed. I knew I would see my mother again someday, and God had comforted me in a way I would never have expected. He had turned my sorrow into incredible joy. A few days later, I copied Bob's sister's address off his chart and wrote to her. I gave her the detailed moments of our time with her brother, sharing his salvation and the fact that we would see him again in heaven. She wrote back and told me that her brother had been angry with God for many years and was very cynical. She thanked us, and I thought that was the end of it. 10 years later, as I was combing my hair in an employee's lounge, a woman whom I did not recognize walked in. When she looked at me, she said, "I know you. You're one of the girls that spent all that time with Bob Scott before he died." It turns out that this was a nurse who had been working during the last days of Bob's life. She told me that the entire staff was affected by the fact that Jenny and I had willingly spent so much time with Bob. I do not know the extent of the work God did in those 3 days or whose life he touched, but someday I will know, probably in heaven. From this experience, I came to realize several things about God. 1. He honors his word. 2. He honors those who seek him and his will. 3. He honors obedience. 4. He comforts his own. Remember, I was still grieving the loss of my mom. And 5. He is faithful to the end to reach those who will accept his offer of salvation. Most of all, I realized that as long as there is breath in a man, there is hope. How can I help but praise the Lord?
This must be what purgatory is like.
In 1993, I was in my early 40s and leading what I considered a meaningful, balanced life. When I felt myself drawn to prayer, meditation, and reading, I realized that I was put on this earth for a purpose other than living a self-directed, self-centered life. I recognized that I was being awakened to spirituality, and one day I asked Jesus to come into my life. I understood that anything that came into my life after that time
was according to God's will and would be for my better good. That year, I met a man who turned out to be perfect for me, although neither of us was looking for a mate. During the months of our courtship, we made weekend trips to a small town near the Texas Gulf Coast looking for a home. We both felt that we would be living near the water, and when we found a tiny white brick house built in the 1950s, we bought it. I left my big city, high-tech job and landed secretarial work in our new hometown, and Alan retired with half pay from his job. Then we got married and moved. Our life was simple and fulfilling. While I was at work, Alan took care of the house, did yard work, and cooked the meals. We got a great buy on a boat and spent every possible moment fishing. I discovered I was born to fish. About a year later, we found that it takes only a moment to alter a life forever. On a cool November Monday evening, Alan and I were watching Monday Night Football, one of our favorite pastimes. Alan was a big fan of the Dallas Cowboys, and I was a Packer backer. After the game, we retired for the night with no premonition of what was about to happen. Around 4 o'clock that morning, my husband of only 13 months suffered a massive stroke. Thus began our journey into desperation and faith. The ambulance took Alan to our local hospital, and I could tell by watching the staff that he was in serious trouble. I heard the word stroke, but even though I had certainly heard the word before, I had no idea what it actually meant. Very quickly, Alan was transferred to a hospital in a large metropolitan area. In the pre-dawn darkness, I filled the car with gas and packed a small bag in case he was kept overnight. One of our fishing buddies drove the car for me as we followed the ambulance to the hospital. Alan was rushed to the intensive care unit as soon as we arrived, and I began the long wait. I believe faith in God's leadership makes traumatic experiences felt more completely because of two definite things. While the active mind deals with circumstances and their ramifications, the inner mind struggles to keep the connection with God uppermost and strong. The maybe overnight turned into days, and on my third day of camping out in the ICU waiting room, short on sleep, needing a shower, and wearing wrinkled clothes, my soul wailed, "Lord, how can my will and your will be so far apart? Alan can no longer speak, and his blood pressure is still not stabilized. You know I have loved you with all my heart. Help me." For the first time since Alan's stroke, I broke down and cried. A woman in the waiting room recognized my anguish and snatched me up. Although she had been keeping a 24-hour-a-day vigil for her husband, she saw my need and sprung into action. I'm 5'8", and Yolanda is barely 5'2", but she pretty much carried me downstairs to the chapel. She prostrated herself before the altar and prayed for me when I could not. She reaffirmed my faith in God and in humankind. I will never, ever forget Yolanda. She lived nearby, so she brought me some of her clothes, and then she took mine home and washed them for me. I had no idea at the time that I would be needing my clothes and hers. Alan's blood pressure stabilized, so they transferred him to the critical care floor. Confused and unfocused, he no longer looked like himself. Eyes that were helpless and frightened peered out of a face that struggled to communicate one-word concepts. During the next 2 weeks on the critical care floor, the word I heard most often was brow. He constantly begged for a cool washcloth to be placed on his forehead. He was disoriented, his right side was paralyzed, and his vision was severely impaired. Unable to move, he wore diapers. Unable to eat, he was spoon-fed, usually by me. And because he couldn't feel the right side of his mouth, he was a mess. The next 9 weeks were filled with misery because many negative things piled up in addition to Alan's health crisis. When Alan was transferred to the rehabilitation floor, I left the hospital for the first time since his stroke. Sobbing from the depths of his being, Alan begged me not to leave him, and because of brain damage, he couldn't understand that I needed to get back to my job. All he knew was that he was going to be alone and unprotected because I was abandoning him. He had no concept of time and couldn't comprehend that I would be back on the weekend. I felt like I was going to die with pain. I wept all the way home. My weekly routine became a picture of purgatory in my mind. On Thursday nights, I would gas up the car and pack a suitcase so that I would be prepared to head for the hospital immediately after work on Friday. I spent the weekends with Alan, catching what little sleep I could in the window seat in his room. I'd wash his clothes and share every minute of his day with him until Sunday evening. Then came the sobbing departure and the 2-hour drive back home. I soon became totally exhausted. Eventually, Alan learned to establish balance, although learning to sit was difficult because his brain did not acknowledge that his body had a right side. He was taught to raise his head, which hung so far down that his chin touched his chest. He had to be taught to make eye contact. In his simple state, he got used to wearing diapers, so potty training was next in the long process of rehabilitation. Then there were the tasks of basic hygiene. Combing his hair became a project and was helped along with notes taped to his mirror. Pick up the comb. Comb both sides of your hair. Put the comb back down. Even with the notes, he would look straight into the mirror and comb only the hair on the left side of his head. It could get so frustrating. As Alan's discharge drew near, I was urged to find a nursing home for him. I found out that his insurance would not cover the expense, and that's when desperation set in. I suddenly realized that I would be bringing Alan home, and there wouldn't be the safety and structure of the hospital environment. I was on my own, with the enormous responsibility of being the sole source of Alan's care and well-being. I sold the boat to help defray medical expenses and brought my husband home in late January. Our neighbor, a retired military physician's assistant, took over Alan's care during the day so I could work. You cannot imagine how much time must be invested in something as simple as hygiene, and February, March, April, and May swirled by in a blur. Believe me, I developed a deep empathy for caregivers. Bathing, dressing, and grooming a 275-pound man took a lot of strength and time. Then there was the care of the house and yard, preparing meals, doing dishes and laundry, emptying garbage, and holding down a full-time job. I got very close to the breaking point. Friends were faithful in giving me books. I prayed, I submitted, I got very little sleep because Alan woke me up several times each night with small needs. He really didn't have any concept of anyone's needs but his own. He had convulsion-like episodes at night, and one night he vomited in bed. But always, the next morning, I would get him up and clean, dress, and feed him. Then I was off to work again. It broke my heart to watch my husband lose everything by which he defined himself. He battled depression over his physical condition, and his state of confusion further dulled his ability to understand and cope with his new status. In May, I quit my job. I had lost 25 pounds and was physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually drained. I got 2 part-time jobs, and life developed a routine that was a little easier for me. I learned to stop struggling and trying so desperately to get things back to the way they had once been. Alan and I had lost so much, and I had to accept it and search for the good. Part of his brain had been destroyed. I couldn't heal it. His body was disabled. I couldn't fix it. The relationship we had bet our lives on no longer existed. I couldn't bring it back. Our financial plans were out the window, and I could not hold on to our dreams. It does no good to worry about emotional loss, mental loss, physical loss, financial loss, material loss, and loss of friends. I discovered a deeper love and sense of service, a humbling of self in order to focus on another, and an amazing sense of oneness with my spouse. I also developed a greater love and respect, not for what once was, but for what now is. And there is such a rich sense of peace. For 4 years, my routine went something like this. Awaken Alan each morning with a smile and a joke. Help him sit, then stand, so I can change his clothing. Wash his face, shampoo his hair. Feed him a good breakfast, and dispense medications. Then help him with personal hygiene, put toothpaste on his toothbrush, and check to be sure he turns on the faucet. Clean his eyeglasses, settle him in front of the TV, and go to work. At home in the evening, we would discuss the antics of the Deputy of Disaster on the Andy Griffith Show. We battled wits on Jeopardy, even though he was delighted because he had watched the same program earlier in the day on a different channel and knew all the answers. He knew that I knew his little secret, and it was all part of the game for him. Here was the routine. Make dinner, do the dishes, help him into bed, rub his leg and arm with lotion, curl up beside him, and read him to sleep. Finally, I would turn off the lights, slip to the back of the house, and replenish myself through prayer, reading, and thought, and give thanks.
In the summer of 2000, Alan developed chest pain and was hospitalized for 2 weeks. His digestive tract stopped working and he was diagnosed with diabetes. He had another stroke, and he was dying. I brought him home under hospice care. While he was able to talk, he told me he felt God's presence. I asked him, "Where?" And he patted his chest. I asked him what God feels like, and he answered, "Nice, fluttery, like butterflies." I asked him if he could see God, and he said, "No, but I can see my father and stepmother." They had died in 1999. When I asked him what they were doing, he replied, "They're waiting for me." His breathing became shallow and slow. He looked like an angel to me, and shortly before he died, I became aware that I was being filled up with an overwhelming sense of joy. When Alan took his last breath, I felt the room lighten. It was an odd sensation, but I could still sense his presence, so I talked to him. Then I felt that he and the lightness were gone. In the months since my husband's death, I have been busy reordering the details of my life and following God's leading. Do I still believe that all things lead to good according to God's purpose? I can answer with a resounding yes. It is a blessing to know the difference between understanding with my mind and understanding with my heart, between loving from my head and loving from my heart. There are times I feel overwhelmed with grief, yes, but more often I focus on the truth of absent from the body, present with the Lord, and I give thanks. Schizophrenia stole my son. In 1985, my 16-year-old son Jeffrey began to change in ways that completely puzzled those who knew him. He had always been a pleasant, well-mannered, fun-loving boy with lots of friends, and seemingly overnight he became reclusive. He stopped studying and reading and didn't want to leave the house after he got home from school in the afternoons. Jeffrey's teachers and counselors at school had no idea what was wrong with him. Hence, they didn't know how to deal with him. They told me that if I didn't allow him to quit school, they were going to expel him on the grounds that he was incorrigible. Incorrigible? I wanted to know what he was doing to warrant this label. Well, he wasn't doing anything wrong, he was just doing nothing, and they needed to make room for a student who would study. So what choice did I have? I took him out of school. After he was finally diagnosed, I came to understand that his illness eradicated his ability to read and spell. How terrible it is to see your child deteriorate right before your eyes. I didn't have an inkling of what to do for Jeffrey, and at first I honestly thought he was being rebellious. He became more uncommunicative, almost sullen, and retreated into his private world. He became increasingly worse as time went by, and I became more and more alarmed. I now know that he was showing all the classic signs of schizophrenia, but I didn't know it then. After all, I had no experience with such things. A few years ago, schizophrenia was classified as a disease of the brain, and it is the most common form of psychotic illness. It affects the thoughts, concentration, and speech of the person suffering with it. Symptoms include hallucinations, delusions, hearing voices, and paranoia. Usually, the person cannot keep a job even if he is able to get hired. For 2 years, my family tried everything we knew to help Jeffrey. But when he was 18, he suffered a delusion that forced us to hospitalize him. That's when we finally got a diagnosis for him as well. Schizophrenia paranoia. Watching my beloved son suffer from this brain disease caused me to go through several stages of grief. 1. Blame someone. I questioned God. I told him, "Father, when Jeffrey was born, I thanked you that he was not mentally challenged. And now, 18 years later, he has a brain disease. He can't reason. He can't tell what's real and what's not. And he is unable to maintain friendships. Why would you let me think he was okay at birth, and now we learn that he's not okay?" 2. Blame myself. I kept telling myself that I must have done something wrong in bringing him up. Research shows that parents do not do anything during child-rearing to cause schizophrenia. 3. Guilt. Why does Jeffrey have to be like this? Here I am, able to think, work, and deal with life. I feel so guilty that he has to suffer this awful illness and I don't have to suffer. My thoughts tormented me.
I would wonder, why did God tell us in 2 Timothy 1:7 that he has given us a sound mind? My son doesn't have a sound mind, so is this in opposition to the scriptures? Many days at work, I would think of Jeffrey and cry, thinking, it's almost like the real person is dead because he has lost his personality and mental abilities. He's no longer the same person. Through the years of my son's illness, some people may have thought, oh, her faith just isn't strong enough in the Lord. I sometimes felt that's what they were thinking. But I found that faith grows day by day as we experience the trials of life. My faith grew stronger and I became more patient and serene as time went by. The Lord allowed several things to happen in my life that showed me how he was in complete control of everything. 1. I looked for a job for almost 2 years and was surprised that I couldn't find one. I had always been able to find a job rather quickly. After I was hired at a school of nursing, I could see the hand of God at work in keeping certain jobs closed to me and guiding me to this one. He wanted me in this particular setting so that I could receive help when I learned of Jeffrey's illness. I worked as a secretary for the professors at the school, highly educated Christians who encouraged me. They often came to my office to share their knowledge or to testify, and they helped me see that bad things also happen to other Christians. It made me feel less alone in my grief and struggle. 2. The Lord led me to a Christian counselor who helped me see things from a Christian perspective. When my insurance would no longer pay for me to see this counselor, he continued to see me without charge, further demonstrating to me the love of Christ. 3. The Lord helped me grow through the Christian books I read. He led me to specific books in a secondhand store. 4. The Lord led me to a woman close to my age who became a friend. Her son was suffering from a mental illness and was charged with a felony that he committed during an episode of hallucination. The judge did not even consider his brain disease and gave him a life sentence. She and her husband now have a prison ministry through their church. Their son's disease has not affected his reasoning and his sense of reality, so he witnesses to prisoners. When one gets saved or is open to hearing more about salvation, he sends the prisoner's name to his mother. She finds someone to write or disciple the prisoner, and over 40 inmates have been saved through her son's witness. My friend and her husband write to inmates and visit several every other week. I now write to 15 Christian prisoners and send them Christian books, Bible studies which I have written, and Christian articles. I also pray for them regularly. I have found that during trials it helps to put our grief and anger into something constructive, so that's what my friend and I are doing. I feel that this is one way the Lord has taught me to cope. She and I also encourage one another. A couple of years ago, Jeffrey was hallucinating and stabbed a person 11 times, once in the face. He now faces a trial by jury, and if convicted, he could go to prison for 20 years. Every time the trial date comes up, the jail psychiatrist diagnoses him as incompetent to stand trial, and he is sent to a state medical hospital with maximum security. They have the necessary funding to give him the medication he needs, and when the medication works, he passes the competency test and is sent back to jail. There is not enough funding in the jail system to give him the medication, so he is sent back to the hospital. This is the way it goes, back and forth, up and down, and it keeps us all in emotional turmoil. I face each day trusting in God's grace in this time of testing and suffering, and he is so faithful. I also trust God that he will reveal himself to Jeffrey in ways that only he can, and I continue to praise him.
You've been listening to Part 5 of Triumph Through Tragedy, read by Stephanie Staples Rostad and Jason Staples. This podcast is brought to you by World Challenge, transforming lives through the message and mission of Jesus Christ. World Challenge is incredibly thankful for the support we receive from many people across the country who believe in our mission. We are able to continue creating resources like this podcast because of donations from listeners like you. You can make a donation on our website, worldchallenge.org. Thank you for listening and supporting. In the next episode of Triumph Through Tragedy, Death of a Loved One. Until then, may God's presence and grace help you become more than a conqueror through suffering.